Chapter 5. Symbols of Life and Growth. In England we have four distinct seasons: spring, summer, autumn and winter. But this particular pattern is not universal. In northern India, which provides the backdrop for the White Lotus Sutra, there are three seasons in the year of about 4 months each. There's the cold season, when by Indian standards it's cold all the time, a bit like an English summer without the rain. Then there's the hot season, which is very hot indeed. There's no rain at all, not even a drop, and it seems to get hotter and hotter and hotter. The leaves drop off the trees, and all the vegetation turns brown and dry. The earth is baked brick hard, and towards the end of the hot season, great fissures appear in the ground, some of them so wide and deep that you have to be careful as you walk along not to fall into them. Cows wandering in search of food kick up a thick dust which turns the whole atmosphere a dull yellow. Then, come July, before your very eyes, the rainy season begins. 1 minute the weather is hot and bright, the next, with miraculous speed, a huge dark cloud appears, blotting out the sun, and within a few minutes the whole sky is overcast, deep greyish-blue, turning almost black. On every side, lightning flickers and flashes, and terrible crashes of thunder roll from one end of the sky to the other. Then you hear a great sound, like the rushing of a tremendous wind, and down comes the rain. It comes down in great bucketfuls for days and days and days. Water swirls underfoot all the time, and the ground is a great sea of mud. The rivers turn yellow and overflow their banks. Here and there in the villages, the mud walls of the huts collapse, and sometimes whole villages are swept away. But then, just a few days after the rainy season has begun, a wonderful thing happens. Just like magic, the yellow, parched land suddenly becomes entirely green, and vegetation of every kind springs up. The rice fields are filled with emerald shoots, and even the most stunted bushes and shrubs burst into leaf. The bamboo and the plantain shoot up inches in a single night. Every shrub, every tree, every bush, every plant starts to grow. After so many months of intense heat and dryness, the start of the rainy season in India is greeted with a joy which it is hard to imagine English people feeling for April showers. The Indian monsoon comes as a tremendous relief, the worker of a magical transformation. The scene is often represented in art, especially in the Mughal miniature paintings, and described in Pali and Sanskrit literature. It is also depicted in the parable called the Rain Cloud, also known as the Parable of the Plants, which occurs in the 5th chapter of the White Lotus Sutra. In Suthil's translation from Kumarajiva's Chinese version, this is what the Buddha says. It is like unto a great cloud rising above the world, covering all things everywhere. A gracious cloud full of moisture. Lightning flames flash and dazzle. A voice of thunder vibrates afar, bringing joy and ease to all. The sun's rays are veiled, and the earth is cooled. The cloud lowers and spreads, as if it might be caught and gathered. Its rain everywhere equally descends on all sides, streaming and pouring unstinted, permeating the land. On mountains, by rivers, in valleys, in hidden recesses, there grow the plants, trees and herbs, trees both great and small. The shoots of the ripening grain, grapevine and sugarcane, fertilized are these by the rain, and abundantly enriched. The dry ground is soaked. Herbs and trees flourish together. From the one water which issued from that cloud, plants, trees, thickets, forests, according to need, receive moisture. All the various trees, lofty, medium, low, each according to its size, grows and develops roots, stalks, branches, leaves, blossoms and fruits in their brilliant colours. Wherever the one rain reaches, all become fresh and glossy. According as their bodies, forms and natures are great or small, so the enriching rain, though it is one and the same, makes each of them flourish. In like manner also the Buddha appears here in the world, like unto a great cloud universally covering all things. And, having appeared in the world, he, for the sake of the living, discriminates and proclaims the truth in regard to all laws. The great, holy, world-honoured one, among the gods and men, and among other beings, proclaims abroad this word: I am the Tathagata, the most honoured among men. I appear in the world like unto this great cloud, to pour enrichment on all parched living beings, to free them from their misery, to attain the joy of peace, joy of the present world, and joy of Nirvana. Gods, men, and everyone, hearken well with your mind. Come you here to me, behold the peerless honoured one. I am the world-honoured, who cannot be equalled. To give rest to every creature, I appear in the world, and to the hosts of the living, preach the pure law, sweet as dew, the one and only law of deliverance and Nirvana. With one transcendent voice, I proclaim this truth, ever taking the great vehicle as my subject. Upon all I ever look, everywhere impartially, without distinction of persons, or mind of love or hate. I have no predilections, nor any limitations. Ever to all beings I preach the law equally. As I preach to one person, so I preach to all. Ever I proclaim the law, engaged in naught else. Going, coming, sitting, standing, never am I weary of pouring it copious on the world, like the all-enriching rain. On honoured and humble, high and low, law-keepers and law-breakers, those of perfect character and those of imperfect, orthodox and heterodox, quick-witted and dull-witted, equally I rain the law-rain unwearyingly. There is no need to comment on the specific details of this parable. The general meaning is obvious enough. But before moving on to consider the parable's implications, I want to comment on the kind of symbolism it introduces, the symbolism of life and growth. Now clearly the parables of which we have met so far are also symbols of life and growth. In the parable of the burning house, the children, that is to say sentient beings, are depicted as moving from a state of potential suffering to a state of everlasting bliss, peace and happiness. In the parable of the return journey, the poor man comes closer and closer to the rich man, becoming more and more like him, and is in the end acknowledged as his son and heir. So in both these parables there is growth, onward and upward movement. In fact, we could say that the whole White Lotus Sutra is a symbol of life and growth, for it depicts a universe in which every living thing is moving upwards. Arhats are becoming bodhisattvas, bodhisattvas are becoming Buddhas. All individual beings whatsoever are moving in the direction of enlightenment. However, the parable of the rain cloud can be singled out specifically as a symbol of life and growth for an obvious reason, because it compares the whole process of spiritual development to the unfolding of a plant. Plant symbolism is much more common in Buddhism than is generally supposed. In fact, the first symbol for humanity to emerge from the enlightened consciousness of the Buddha was a symbol of this kind. If we go back to the time just after the Buddha's enlightenment, we find that he was at first hesitant about going out to teach the truth he had discovered. It was so difficult and subtle. Would anyone else ever be able to understand it? The scriptural records tell us that at that point the Buddha looked out over the world and saw a vision of the whole mass of humanity just like a great bed of lotuses. Many of the lotus plants were not just deep down in the water, but deep down in the mud, so submerged that you could hardly see their buds. But others, the Buddha saw, had begun to grow, so that at least the tips of their buds had emerged above the surface of the water. Other buds stood free of the water and were starting to unfurl their petals, and a very few were on the point of bursting into bloom. Through this beautiful vision of the different stages of development, the Buddha realized that there were at least some individuals who could flower in the sunlight of his teaching, and set out to share his vision of reality. If we turn to a period much later in the Buddha's tradition, we find in Tibetan Buddhism a similar sort of symbolism. According to Tibetan tradition, there are a number of psychic centers which the Tibetans call wheels, 4, 5, or sometimes 7, situated at different points along the median nerve within the human body, one at the stomach, one at the solar plexus, one at the heart, one at the throat, one at the head, and so on. These psychic centers are symbolized by lotuses of different sizes and colors, and with different numbers of petals. Practitioners who use this symbolism say that in meditation, especially in certain esoteric meditation practices, a powerful current of upward-moving energy is generated within the body. This current is called in Buddhist Sanskrit Chandali, the fiery one. It corresponds to the Tibetan Tummo, usually translated as psychic heat, and the Hindu Kundalini, the coiled-up one, an evocative term for coiled-up potential energy. In all these traditions, this potential energy is often represented as a serpent. As the energy passes up the median nerve, it activates the different centers, and the lotus flowers open. The higher up the center, the bigger and more beautiful the lotus. Leaving aside the question of whether we can take the symbolism of the psychic centers and the current of energy literally, or whether it is metaphorical, the lotus here symbolizes the whole process of spiritual development. White Tara is one of the most popular of the archetypal bodhisattvas of Buddhist tradition. As her name suggests, she is completely white in color, a beautiful, graceful, smiling figure, usually seated in Siddhasana and clad in the silks and jewels of a bodhisattva. In her left hand, she holds a whole spray of lotuses. And here there is a very interesting point to notice. The spray of lotuses consists of a closed lotus bud, a half-open bud, and a fully open flower. Now these lotuses could represent, for example, the Buddhas of the three times, the past, the present, and the future. No doubt the symbolism is rich and capable of many interpretations. But the simplest and most obvious meaning is that White Tara's three lotuses represent the process of growth and unfoldment, which is the spiritual life. This kind of symbolism, then, is frequently found in the Buddhist tradition. But why, in Chapter 5, does the White Lotus Sutra suddenly start talking in terms of plants and their growth? Well, you could say that it just happened like that it was an accident, but I don't personally believe that. I believe that this kind of symbolism is introduced at this point in the sutra for a very definite purpose. It is there to correct a mistake which it is only too easy to make if we take certain details of the previous parables, the burning house and the return journey, too literally, a mistake which may lead us to misinterpret the whole process of the spiritual life. In the parable of the burning house, the children are persuaded to come from the inside of the building to the outside. In the myth of the return journey, the poor man comes from a distant country to his father's city, and then to his father's mansion. In both parables, then, there is a change of place, a journey, of movement in space. Now, the characteristic feature of movement in space is that the moving object changes its position, but does not itself change. In other words, the change that takes place is external, not internal. So if we take the parables literally, the danger is that we will understand the process of spiritual development not in terms of internal change, but in terms of external change. This means that, consciously or semi-consciously, we will think of the self as having experiences, traversing changes, but itself remaining unchanged. This misunderstanding does represent a very real danger, and one that we are all likely to encounter or even succumb to. It is easy enough to study the history of Buddhism. It is easy enough to become acquainted with all the doctrines and study the different stages of the path. The danger is that we may start to mistake our intellectual journey through those stages for real experience. We may be aware that our understanding of nirvana itself is only theoretical, but it may not be so obvious that our understanding and knowledge of the earlier stages is also quite theoretical. If we are not careful, we will not be aware that we are not passing through them in actual experience, but only mentally, that is, externally. There's no internal change taking place at all. For example, many books on Buddhism refer to the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. There's no getting away from it, and quite rightly so. But it is very often misrepresented. We are given a picture of a path divided into eight stages, and encouraged to think of ourselves traversing it stage by stage. But it isn't like that at all. Following the Noble Eightfold Path is in practice much more like putting forth, one after another, eight successive shoots or branches. This is reflected in the term for the Eightfold Path in Pali, Atangika Maga, and Sanskrit, Astangika Maga. Anga does not mean a step or stage, but a limb, shoot or branch. So following the Eightfold Path is not at all like climbing a ladder rung by rung, but more like rising up as the sap rises up through a tree when the rain falls. Taking the analogy further, we could say that the first of these shoots, perfect vision or transcendental consciousness, is like the rain. When you get your first glimpse of transcendental consciousness, your first experience above and beyond the limitations of your ordinary self, like rain spreading through the soil, it gradually permeates and influences all other aspects of your being. It spreads to your emotional life, your speech, your activities, your way of earning a living, your mental state, your whole way of life. So practicing the Noble Eightfold Path is not a matter of following a path step by step, but of imbibing a certain inspiration, having a certain experience, and then allowing that to permeate all aspects of your being, until you are permanently saturated in that experience at all levels. At that point of perfect and complete transformation, you reach the eighth step of the Transcendental Eightfold Path, the perfect samadhi, and you attain the enlightenment of a Buddha. It is to stop us from mistaking external change for internal change, from mistaking intellectual understanding for personal experience, that the White Lotus Sutra adds to the symbol of the journey the symbol of the plant. The symbol of the journey apparently has two factors, the path itself and the person treading the path. In the symbolism of the plant, however, these two factors come together to produce a single factor. The plant itself is the process of development, so there is no possibility of any misunderstanding. Instead of thinking of ourselves as traversing the path, we now think of ourselves as plants, as living, growing things. The only question that arises is that of what stage we have reached. Are we still buds, submerged in the water or the mud? Or are we half-open flowers? Or are we even in full bloom? Whatever stage a plant has reached, it needs both rain and sun to help it grow. It is appropriate, then, that sun imagery is also introduced in the White Lotus Sutra in a parable which follows directly after the parable of the rain cloud, the parable of the sun and moon. The Buddha does not elaborate upon this parable, and it is so short that it is in fact more like a simile than a parable. This is Kern's translation from the Sanskrit. And further, Kashyapa, the Tathagata, in his educating creatures, is equal and not unequal. As the light of the sun and moon, Kashyapa, shines upon all the world, upon the virtuous and the wicked, upon high and low, upon the fragrant and the ill-smelling, as their beams are sent down upon everything equally, without any inequality. So too, Kashyapa, the intellectual light of the knowledge of the omniscient, the Tathagatas, the Arhats, etc., the preaching of the true law proceeds equally in respect to all beings in the five states of existence, to all who, according to their particular disposition, are devoted to the great vehicle, or to the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddhas, or to the vehicle of the disciples. Nor is there any deficiency or excess in the brightness of the Tathagata knowledge, up to one's becoming fully acquainted with the law. The sun and moon are, of course, universal symbols, and like plant and flower symbolism, they feature frequently in Buddhist tradition. In Tantric Buddhism, the sun is embodied especially in the figure of Vairochana, who occupies the centre of the mandala of the five Buddhas. His name means simply illuminator. In the Vedas, the pre-Buddhistic scriptures, Vairochana is one of the names of the sun. And in Japanese Buddhism, he is known as Dainichi, the great sun Buddha. Iconographically, he is represented as being brilliant white in colour, like the sun at its midday brightest, and he is shown holding his emblem, the eight-spoked golden wheel of the Dharma. His fingers make the wheel-turning gesture, the Dharma Chakra Pravartana, which is associated with the Buddha's first teaching at Sarnath, and represents the dissemination of the truth in all possible directions, just like the beams of the sun shining in all directions of space. The lotus throne on which Vairochana is sitting is supported by lions, the lion itself being a solar symbol. Furthermore, according to Indian mythology, when the lion roars in the jungle at night, all the other beasts fall silent. The Buddha, we are told in the scriptures, preaches his Dharma with a lion-like roar, Singhanada. When truth is given utterance by the Buddha, all partial truths or untruths fall silent. In the White Lotus Sutra 2, the sun is a symbol for the Buddha's teaching. In some respects, the meaning of its symbolism in the sutra is identical to that of the rain cloud. Both are indispensable to the life and growth of the plant. And both are absolutely impartial. This is stressed in both parables. The rain cloud gives the same moisture, and the sun gives the same light and heat to each and every plant on the earth. The cloud doesn't give some plants a heavier shower of rain than others. The sun doesn't treat some plants to a purer or brighter light. In the same way, in principle, the Buddha gives the same teaching, communicates the same reality, the same higher state of consciousness to all living beings. The teaching has different forms, just as the rain consists of individual drops and the sunshine of individual rays. But all the forms have one and the same meaning, just as each raindrop is made of water and each sunbeam is made of light. The quality of impartiality is particularly drawn out in the parable of the rain cloud. The word which the Buddha uses to describe the rain is ekarasa, ekar meaning one, and rasa meaning taste, juice, or essence. This same word is used in a similar connotation, similar connection, in another parable, one which occurs in the Pali scriptures, the parable of the great ocean. The Buddha says that wherever you go in the great ocean, you can scoop a handful of water, and it will have the same taste, the taste of salt. Likewise, whatsoever part of his teaching you take up, it will have one taste, the taste of freedom. In other words, whatever aspect of the Buddha's teaching you practice, it has one essence, one purpose, one effect, to help you to get free from your conditioning. There are many different presentations of the Buddha's teaching. There are the lists, the Eightfold Path, the Five Spiritual Faculties, the Three Refuges. There are the teachings about suffering, impermanence, and no self. And there are all sorts of methods of practice, the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, the contemplation of the impurities, the brahma viharas. But all these many teachings, traditions and practices have just one aim, to help individual human beings to become free from their conditioning. From this, the important corollary follows that the Buddha's teaching is not to be identified with any one formulation. It is not possible to say that the Buddha's teaching is the Noble Eightfold Path and just that, or the contents of the Pali Canon and just that. The Buddha's teaching is not just Zen, or just Theravada, or just what Professor so-and-so says it is. Buddhism cannot be identified with any one individual formulation, much less with any one individual school or sect. The Buddha's teaching or message can only be identified with that spirit of liberation, of freedom from conditionedness, that pervades all these formulations, just as the taste of salt pervades all the oceans, all the waters of the ocean. Whether it is the teaching of the Eightfold Path, or the teaching of the Bodhisattva ideal, whether it is this meditation practice or that, if it helps us to become free from our conditioning, it is part and parcel of the Buddha's teaching. When we read about Buddhism, it is very important not only to remember this, but to try really to feel it. Otherwise, all our studies and knowledge will be in vain. When we read the scriptures or hear about the Buddha's teaching, it is not enough just to pay attention to the words, the ideas and concepts. What really matters is to feel, through the concepts, through the images and symbolism, that which informs and gives life to them all, the experience of emancipation from all conditions whatsoever. In other words, we are trying to feel, at least to some degree, the absolute consciousness of the Buddha, the enlightened consciousness from which all the teachings originally came. Now, although the rain falls on all alike, and the sun shines on all alike, the plants themselves are all different, and they grow in different ways. A nut grows into a tree, and a seed into a flower. A rose bush produces big red blossoms, whereas a crocus bulb produces small yellow ones. Some plants shoot up into the air, others creep along the ground, and others clasp bigger and stronger plants. They all grow according to their own nature. And it is just the same, the parable suggests, with human beings. They all receive the same truth, they all hear what is in principle the same spiritual teaching, and they all grow. But the strange, astonishing, and wonderful thing is that they all grow in different ways. They all grow according to their own nature. People may all hear the same teaching, believe in the same teaching, and follow the same path, but they do what seem to be completely different things. Some become more and more deeply involved in meditation, so that in the end they are spending most of their time meditating and have hardly any contact with other people. Others take up social work. Others burst into song, write poetry, or paint pictures. And others, perhaps the majority, simply go on being themselves. They do not display any specific talent, but just become more and more individual. The paradox is that although we each become more and more different from one another as we grow and develop, at the same time we also become more and more like one another, more aware, more sensitive, more compassionate, in a word, more alive. This means that in the spiritual life there can be no question of regimentation. It is reasonable to expect that, with a little endeavour, all human beings will grow, but it is unreasonable to expect that all human beings will grow in the same way. This, unfortunately, is often forgotten. When we discover something that we ourselves find very helpful to our own development, we tend to think that everybody else should also find it helpful. Indeed, if we are not careful, we even start insisting that they must find it helpful. Or, conversely, we discover that something is not helpful to us, at least at present, and therefore refuse to recognize that it is helpful to other people. It is this kind of fixed attitude which leads to sectarianism in Buddhism. When people hit upon a helpful approach to their spiritual development, rather than just making use of it, they are quick to declare that the school or method they have discovered is Buddhism. If you don't follow this school, they say, you can't really be a Buddhist. This is just as bad as Orthodox Christianity, and indeed represents a carrying over of Christian attitudes into Buddhist life. I must confess that I found a lot of this sort of thing in the English Buddhist movement when I came back in 1964 after spending 20 years in the East. For instance, there were some people who, quite rightly, found meditation very helpful indeed, and devoted a number of hours every day to practicing it. And because they found meditation so helpful, they used to declare that the practice of studying the scriptures, or reading about Buddhism at all, was completely useless. In their opinion, nobody who called themselves a Buddhist should be expected, or even allowed to, do anything other than meditate. But there were other people I found who preferred to study, and these people, who tended to be rather bookish, would say that people in the West, being tense and full of problems, and rather difficult in all sorts of ways, were simply not ready for so sublime a spiritual practice as meditation, and ought to stick to reading books. Some people went so far as to say that meditation was dangerous, and that if you insisted on doing it at all, 5 minutes at a time was quite enough. Other people, again, were against anything ceremonial or colourful. They did not find ritual helpful themselves, for one reason or another, so they tended to say it was bad for everybody. We need to be careful not to get stuck in fixed ideas about which Buddhist school is best, particular Buddhist school is best, or which kind of Buddhist practice is best. Furthermore, we need to examine our fixed ideas about what Buddhism is, even what religion is. Again, we can take as our reference point the parables of the White Lotus Sutra, which say that the rain falls and the sun shines on the good and the bad alike. But in applying this to our own situation, I want to put it rather differently. The rain falls and the sun shines on the religious and the secular alike. For a couple of thousand years in the West, all cultures and communities were officially religious. This meant that you could only develop higher states of consciousness through traditional religious means, prayer, meditation, the sacraments, and so on. If you wanted to evolve, you had to be a religious person and do it in the religious way. You had to be a pious churchgoer, or a religious scholar, or a mystic. But a great change has taken place. It began at the time of the Renaissance, when thinkers, philosophers, and artists started separating, some would say emancipating, themselves from the tutelage of religion. Then, after the Industrial Revolution, the whole process speeded up, and today, in most Western countries, and the change is spreading to the East as well, communities and cultures are secular rather than religious. Art is secular art. It has no direct connection with conventional or traditional religion. And literature is very definitely secular literature. But despite this split between the religious and the secular, the high evolution is still possible. In the modern world, especially in the West, it can take place not only in religious, but also in secular terms. Indeed, in the West today, spiritual progress is more likely to take place within a secular context than within a conventional religious one. All that is traditionally or conventionally associated with the word religion has little appeal now for the vast majority of thinking people. One can even go so far as to say, to put it bluntly, that those who go to church are probably not very interested in religion, and those who are very interested in religion are unlikely to go to church. It might be better, therefore, to present the high evolution of man not in conventional religious terms at all, but in secular terms. Perhaps more people would then be attracted to the teachings and benefit from them. It may be that one day we shall have to conclude that in sticking to traditional religious forms, including Eastern religious forms, we are being unimaginative and unrealistic, and perhaps even excluding, or at least not encouraging, some people who could benefit from the teachings of the higher evolution. The rain falls and the sun shines on the religious and the secular alike. Both rain and sunshine help all plants to grow in their own way. In everything that we have seen so far, the two parables are similar. But there is a distinction between them, although this distinction does not exactly amount to a difference. The symbolism of the rain cloud and the symbolism of the sun are complementary. The rain cloud gives moisture, whereas the sun gives light and heat. To borrow terms from the Chinese tradition, the rain cloud is yin, associated with the depths, with the earth, and the sun is yang, associated with the heights, with the sky. And in terms of human development, the individual is quite literally like the plant. Just as the plant taps its moisture up from the earth and gets its heat and light from the sky, so the developing human being must be nourished from below, from the unconscious depths, and also from above, from the supra-conscious heights. To translate this into more simple terms, we must be nourished through both emotion and reason. Usually, presentations of Buddhism in the West emphasize the rational aspect, or even give the impression that Buddhism is exclusively rational. We are told about Buddhist thought and philosophy, Buddhist metaphysics, psychology and logic, and sometimes it all seems very dry and academic. The other side, however, the side represented by myth, symbol and the imagination, the emotions and vision, is no less important, and for many people perhaps even more important. This is why we need to absorb texts which appeal to our emotions, like the parables, myths and symbols of the Mahayana in the White Lotus Sutra. It is not enough to understand the Buddha's teaching intellectually. Anybody who has the ability to read and a moderate intelligence can do that. We have to ask ourselves again and again, not just, do I know, do I understand, but do I feel? Do I vibrate with this? We might even ask ourselves, do I really feel like a plant at the end of the hot season? Is this how I feel after a day's work or after I've been immersed in the ordinary daily round? Do I feel all dry and withered? Do I feel in need of nourishment? Do I really feel ready to take something in? When you come in contact with the truth, with the Buddha's teaching, do you actually feel as though you are being refreshed by a great shower of rain? Do you really feel that you are going to drink something in after having been dry and thirsty for a long time? Again, when you come in contact with the Dharma, do you really feel that the sun has come out? During the months of winter, it is not unusual to feel dull and tired, and even miserable, because the sky is grey with fog and mist, and you are cold. You look forward to the spring sunshine, to your summer holiday, to the first beautiful, warm, bright weekend, when you feel that spring is really on the way. When you see the buds begin to open and the flowers blooming in the parks and gardens, you can hardly help but feel a lifting of the heart. You feel as though a new spirit were rising within you. But do you feel like this when you come in contact with the Buddha's teaching? Do you feel as though you are drinking in spiritual sunshine? If you do not respond in this way, your approach is still just intellectual. It is important that we should actually feel ourselves living, feel ourselves growing, just like the plant when the rain falls and the sun shines, feel ourselves expanding. If we feel like this, our birth as human beings is not in vain, for we will ourselves be symbols, living symbols, of life and growth.